and BRAC, building resources across communities. Mr. Abed set up BRAC in 1972 to help refugees returning from India to newly independent Bangladesh. Since then, it's provided social support and small loans to millions of people. Mr. Abed told the BBC that his organisation's programmes now encompass a wide range of activities, from economic and social development, health and education, to human rights and legal services.
When we talk about poverty, it doesn't necessarily mean income and employment, but also education, healthcare, human development, all kinds of things are included in poverty reduction. So when we work on poverty reduction, we are working on multifaceted programs.
A painting by the Impressionist Degas has been stolen from a gallery in France. Police said the Chorus, with an estimated value of $45 million, disappeared from an exhibition in Marseille. The theft was discovered on Thursday morning. BBC News.
You're listening to World Briefing from the BBC with Helen Fawkes. For our listeners in some parts of East Asia, the new year has already dawned, and with it will come the introduction of a massive new free trade area. It'll consist of China and six founding members of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, with almost 2 billion people. It'll be the largest trading bloc in the world, a possible rival to both the European Union and the North American Free Trade Area. With me in the studio now is our economics correspondent, Andrew Walker. So, Andrew, tell me about the countries that are included in this.
Well, there's China and the founding six members of ASEAN, and that includes some, you know, very important trading players, for example, Thailand, Singapore, Malaysia. So all in all, you've got really major powerhouses in the international exporting business. So, you know, it really is a significant contribution to the gradual reduction in trade barriers.
But the WTO says that about 400 regional and bilateral trade agreements are due to be in operation by 2010. Will one more make any difference?
Well, this is a particularly big one. In terms of population, as you've suggested, it's the biggest in the world. In terms of trade value volumes, it's up there in the top few. So this is an especially important example. And I have to say, these kind of preferential trade agreements are rather controversial. For people who believe in that free trade is generally a good thing, they're a bit of a mixed blessing. Of course, they encourage trade within the blocks concerned, but they do have the risk, at least, of freezing out countries on the outside, making it more difficult for others to get in. And they can sometimes divert trade in a way that's not really, that encourages slightly less efficient allocation than you might get with genuinely global free trade.
And it's being flagged up as a rival to the EU and the North American trade blocs. Who'll benefit? I mean, who'll be the winners and who'll be the losers?
Well, the obvious gainers, I think, are likely to be Chinese manufacturers who will be able to export more easily to an increasingly affluent region. There'll also be opportunities for raw materials producers, in particular in Southeast Asia, to export to China. But I do think some of the manufacturers within Southeast Asia are really quite nervous, some at least, don't really think they're ready to face Chinese competition.
Andrew Walker, our economics correspondent, thanks. It was the deadliest attack against US intelligence officials since 1983. Eight Americans working for the CIA in Afghanistan were killed in a suicide bombing at their base in the southeast of the country. It's thought that the bomber infiltrated the Afghan army in Host province near Pakistan, got through security and detonated his suicide belt in a gym where the CIA personnel were presumably relaxing. But the role of the CIA in Afghanistan is probably less obvious than that of the military. So what is that role? Here's our correspondent in Kabul, Peter Grester.
Well, the CIA has been doing a number of things. They've been monitoring a lot of Al-Qaeda and Taliban militants, particularly along the Pakistani border. They've also been operating the drones, the unmanned aircraft that patrol the border region and occasionally carry out airstrikes. The CIA has also been working with the provincial reconstruction teams, the teams that are going back into areas that have been held by the coalition forces to try and rebuild those areas. This is clearly a very serious blow to the CIA. We understand it's the heaviest loss of life that the CIA has experienced since 1983. And we also understand that it trumps all of the other CIA operatives who've been killed in Afghanistan since this war began.
The Taliban has claimed responsibility for the attack. This was the reaction of some Afghan people to the bombing.
The attack on Khost Airport yesterday targeted people who carry out attacks in Afghanistan and Waziristan. They were organizing airstrikes, either by manned aircraft or drones. So we say that in this attack, the Taliban picked the right target.
The Taliban should not carry out attacks on civilian areas, but it should attack places like the attack yesterday, where there were no civilian casualties. It harmed only the Americans. Such attacks are good because civilians were not hurt.
Although it's emerged that one civilian, Afghan civilian, was killed. The Obama administration is committed to putting in more American soldiers and civilians into Afghanistan to help with both security and reconstruction. So will this mean that foreigners in the country will be targeted more than before? Peter Grester again.
I think everyone has acknowledged that the more troops and civilian contractors that come into Afghanistan, the greater the chances are of civilian and military deaths. But clearly this incident is going to raise some very, very serious questions about the way that the coalition forces are able to operate with the Afghan National Army. Clearly the Afghan National Army is under enormous pressure to recruit very large numbers of soldiers to try and meet the kind of targets that they will need to take over security here as the coalition forces withdraw. That means that it is increasingly difficult to carry out the kinds of background checks that they need to make sure that every member of the Afghan National Army is in fact loyal to the government here and not to the Taliban.
Peter Grester, our correspondent in Kabul. Six people are dead after a gunman opened fire at a shopping centre in Finland. The gunman shot four people at the mall in the city of Espoo. Police say they later found two more bodies. They named the suspect as 43-year-old Ibrahim Shukupoli. Chief Inspector Seppo Rusoselin revealed the results of their investigation so far.
The police received information 10:08 a.m. in the morning that a shooting incident is taking place in the shopping mall of Sello in the city of Espoo. The police took action and found four victims in the shopping mall. However, during the investigation, it has been found out that there are a fifth victim that at the moment seems to be an ex-girlfriend of the suspects. And according the information we have at the moment, it seems that the sixth victim is the suspect of the whole incident.
Chief Inspector Rusoselin. As well as a strong sense of relief, the release on Wednesday of a British hostage captured in Iraq 2.5 years ago has triggered a whole raft of questions. A British newspaper, The Guardian, claims that Iran's Revolutionary Guard masterminded the kidnapping of IT specialist Peter Moore and his four bodyguards, and that they were then taken to Iran. Maggie O'Kane from The Guardian explained their findings.
The Guardian investigation has uncovered the fact that the Iranian Al-Quds force were behind the kidnap of the five British hostages and actually took part in the taking of the hostages. And in our investigation, which has been going on for the last 18 months, we've managed to find eyewitnesses who saw the British hostages being handed over close to the Iranian border at Moran before they were taken into Iran.
It's known that at least three of the hostages later died. With more on the Guardian allegations, here's our security correspondent, Frank Gardner.
The findings in the Guardian's year-long investigation into alleged Iranian involvement in kidnapping Britons in Iraq are being disputed by both British and Iraqi government officials. A senior Foreign Office official said today that while it was not impossible that the British hostages had at some stage been taken across the border into Iran, that did not mean the Iranian authorities themselves were behind the kidnapping. The British government view remains that there is no firm evidence to suggest Iranian government involvement. But The Guardian is sticking by its story, which includes interviews with a number of people who say Iran's Revolutionary Guards were behind the kidnapping. The Foreign Office agrees there are close links between the kidnappers and Iran's Revolutionary Guards, who have provided them and other Iraqi militias with training, funding and weapons.
Frank Gardner. A court in Malaysia has ruled that Christians have the constitutional right to use the name Allah for God. Until today, there was a government ban on non-Muslims using the word. The court was ruling on a lawsuit filed by Malaysia's Roman Catholic Church in 2007. Jennifer Pack has more from Kuala Lumpur.
The landmark ruling means that Christian publications across the country are allowed to use the word Allah to refer to God. Lawyers for the Catholic newspaper argued that the church had been using the word Allah for decades. The Catholic newspaper's editor, Father Lawrence Andrews, says the term Allah is not exclusive to Islam.
We have already been using it for centuries in our worship, in our prayers. So there was no reason why we should all of a sudden be told not to use it.
Malaysia's constitution protects the rights of other religions, so long as they don't encroach on Islam. Some Muslim groups fear that Christians want to use the word Allah as part of a plan to encourage Muslims to convert to Christianity. Malay Muslims, who make up over half of the country's population, are not allowed to convert from Islam. But there is an underlying fear that more and more are converting.
Jennifer Pack reporting. Both the Netherlands and Nigeria say they plan to install full-body scanners at airports following the alleged attempt by a Nigerian man to blow up an American airliner with explosives concealed in his underpants. The suspect boarded a flight in the Nigerian city of Lagos and then changed to flights in Amsterdam on his way to the United States. But the scanners are controversial because they, in effect, look at your body through your clothes. Well, one place that's been using them for the past 2 years is Russia. Our Moscow correspondent Richard Galpin went to see what it was like to have one.
I'm in Moscow's Domodedovo Airport, which is one of the most modern and busiest in the country. And in front of me is a whole line of these full-body scanners. They've been here for the past 2 years, making Russia one of the first countries to actually install them in its airports. Now, I'm actually going to go through the scanner now. You can hear some of the interference there coming from all the electronics. And you stand in this kind of Perspex booth. It's quite a strange experience. The scanner goes round you and you have to stand with your hands in the air as if you're surrendering to the machinery. Then you come out through the other side, and here is an official looking at a computer screen, which is where the image appears. And it's incredibly detailed. It really leaves very little to the imagination, and it is pretty intrusive. So let's now speak to one of the passengers who's actually going through one of the scanners now.
I quite like these machines. Yes, you do lose some privacy, but if it means making life more difficult for drug couriers or indeed for bombers, I'm all for it.
Well, certainly officials here are saying that this full-body scanner system is essential. They're saying it would have foiled the bomb plot over the Christmas period because they're saying the scanner would have picked up, it would have seen the explosives concealed in the man's underwear. Therefore, he would not have been able to get on board the plane.
Richard Galpin reporting from Moscow. It's 1617 on the 31st of December here in London, but some parts of the world are already celebrating New Year. That's the countdown and fireworks at Sydney Opera House in Australia, one of the first cities to start 2010. New Zealand has already celebrated the new year with fireworks, and it's just gone midnight in Beijing. But in Bangladesh, there's a move which is bound to confuse the New Year's celebrations. In June, clocks were put forward by 1 hour for the first time in an attempt to save electricity. But tonight, at exactly 1 minute to midnight, the clocks will be going back again. So does this mean two New Years or none? But Dermot in Dhaka tries to make sense of it all.
The idea of daylight saving, as practiced by dozens of countries around the world, is to move the clocks forward during the summer so that businesses can stay open for an hour longer when the evenings are lighter, and then to move them back for the winter when the days shorten. But here in Bangladesh, the government decided to change the clocks in the middle of the summer and now has chosen to move them back halfway through the winter. If that wasn't confusing enough, it's decreed that the clocks will change tonight at 1 minute to midnight, just as millions of partygoers prepare to wish each other a Happy New Year. The time will go back by 1 hour, so at least the celebrations will last 1 hour longer than normal. The government says that the time change has helped cut electricity consumption, but many Bangladeshis have remained baffled throughout and refused to change their watches.
Mark Dermot in Dhaka. In a moment, a roundup of business news, but first, a reminder of today's main world news from the BBC. A new free trade area, the largest in terms of population in the world, is coming into effect in East Asia. More details have emerged of the killing by an Afghan suicide bomber of 8 Americans working for the CIA. I'm Helen Fawkes. You're listening to the BBC World Service. Now business news, and Lithuania faces the prospect of much higher prices of electricity in the new year. Russell Padmore joins us with the details.
Helen, thank you. The Baltic nation has been forced by the European Union to shut a Chernobyl-style nuclear reactor, but the closure means buying more electricity from abroad at much higher prices. Shares in London are finishing the year on a high note. We'll hear investors who backed mining companies at the start of the decade are among the big winners. And also coming up, the changing face of poverty in New York.
The former working people, middle class as it were, for the first time are now coming in our doors.
We'll get the details on that in the next 10 minutes. Well, the new year brings a tough economic challenge for Lithuania. The Baltic nation is still using an electricity grid that dates back to the Soviet era. And from January, the first atomic station that generates about half of the country's power will be closed down. It could be a decade before Lithuania builds a replacement for the Chernobyl-style Ignalina nuclear plant, which the European Union wants closed on safety grounds. The country will be forced now to buy electricity at higher prices from neighbouring nations, a challenge then for industry and a government that's battling to revive a troubled economy. I asked Lithuania's Prime Minister, Andrius Kubilis, if the country has the generating capacity to replace it.
Well, we have enough generation capacity in Lithuania, but the question is that the price of electricity, if we shall produce all the electricity in Lithuania, will be a little bit larger than to compare when we are importing part of electricity from our neighbours.
Importing is the way you're going. Once you've closed down this power station, you're forced to import power from largely Russia with natural gas and just the one interconnecting link we have with the European Union at the moment. Why have you been so slow to develop more links with the EU, for example?
Well, I think that we can look critically to both sides. I think that interconnections of Baltic states towards European Union is not only the challenge and issue, important issue for the Baltic states itself. It's an important issue for the whole European Union, and I should say that we are happy that during the last several years, EU started to show much more of understanding and interest to build interconnections which were so needed for the Baltic states, but it's very clear that just Baltic states to establish needed interlinks with European markets, it would be a very difficult task.
A lot of foreign investors are looking at the way the Lithuanian economy is going. It does appear for power you are going to be much more dependent on Russia, almost a return to the Soviet days, and let's remember you're still using the power system created by the Soviet era.
Yes, that is our strategic goal, to achieve such a result that we would be able to switch our synchronization system from the old Soviet and just now Russian system towards European system. But again, it will need quite large financial investment, and that will take time.
When you open up the electricity market, that means more investment, largely private investors who want a return in profit. That means the price of electricity goes up, and industry within the country has a choice: swallow higher prices for manufacturing goods or pass them on to the consumer. Are people going to have to expect higher prices in the shops, for example?
Prices for electricity will grow up. We know that from the 1st of January, the prices will be around 20 or 30% larger than they were when we're using our old Ignalina nuclear power station. But we are pushing forward also all the needed investment into renewables. We are also planning to build a new nuclear power station. And at the end, I think that during the next decade, we shall become a normal European country, which will have fully integrated into European energy networks. We are planning to have a nuclear power station, which we are planning to build.
And the people in the country, of course, watching the economic performance of your government, would be looking at things like the very slow way you've been to correct this problem. You still don't have more power links with the European Union. You're still very much reliant on Russia. The country's economy is very, very much in deficit, and electricity prices going up. That's got to be a worry for the ordinary citizen, surely.
Of course, people are worried, but also I think that majority of the people, they understand what a situation we have, and there are no good alternatives.
Lithuanian Prime Minister Andrius Kubilius speaking to me just a little earlier. From the 1st of January, the old Soviet era power station has to close, the nuclear one. Let's look at the London markets now, first off, and it has been a winning year for shares in London. The FTSE doing quite well, up 0.3%, 54.13. It's been a winning year. The FTSE actually up about 22% on the year. Over New York, the Dow is down 0.4%. Right now on the currency markets, the dollar trading at the euro against the dollar, $1.434. The pound is worth $1.61.4. Well, in 2000, the BBC selected 20 global companies to monitor their performance. We've been following their share prices since, many plummeting in value, but the mining giant Rio Tinto is a winner, as our business editor Martin Weber explains.
The economic story of the past decade has been the development of China as the workshop of the world. But the question is, how could global investors take a slice of that astonishing Asian growth? One good idea would have been to invest in the shares of the global mining giant Rio Tinto. Its business is to dig the stuff that manufacturers need out of the ground. It extracts iron ore, aluminium, copper, diamonds and other industrial minerals. Some of its biggest operations are in Australia, but it spans the globe. Its shares soared in recent years. Although the share price is off its peak, Rio's shares are the best performers on the BBC 20 index over the past decade. Runner-up is the drinks group Diageo, which makes Guinness and Smirnoff vodka and sells other brands like Johnnie Walker whiskey to thirsty drinkers around the globe. The big loser on the list, not surprisingly, is the former biggest bank in the world, Citigroup, whose shares have slumped by 90%.
Martin Weber reporting. Now, the US economy is showing signs of life, but for many Americans, there's still little to cheer about. The numbers living below the poverty line are growing. Many are finding it hard to put food on the table. As the BBC's Michelle Fleury found out visiting one New York food pantry where free food is provided for those in need.
Coney Island's seaside amusement park is a victim of neglect, much like many of the local residents. The neighbourhood has one of the highest unemployment rates in Brooklyn. In this part of town, the only thing that's growing is the line at the local food pantry. This one operates out of the basement of a local church.
Those turning to this food pantry for help can expect to find a whole range of nutrients. You've got peanut butter here, you've got low-fat milk, black-eyed peas over here. They've got cans of tuna, rolled oats and even whole wheat macaroni. But what's astonishing is that in the world's largest economy, more and more Americans are struggling to put food on the table, in large part because of the ongoing recession.
You need for real flowers.
I'm sorry. You deserve flowers.
And with jobs vanishing, they're seeing many new faces, according to Nina Valmonte from Catholic Charities in Brooklyn and Queens.
We've seen people that we had not seen before. The former working people, middle class as it were, for the first time are now coming in to our doors. And of course, food is the most immediate need.
Yeah, at the end of January, I lost my position. My salary was very good. And the thing is, like, I wouldn't even consider going to like a food pantry or needing to.
For Eric Lustig, who spent 23 years working in the computer IT industry, the stigma of waiting in line for free food has faded.
I've learned that since coming to these places that, you know, like, people sometimes have a bad connotation of the people that go to these food shelters and homeless shelters and everything. And I'm discovering that a lot is not real. You know, like, it's stereotypes that are false.
There are signs that America's economic situation is improving, but not fast enough. With more living day to day, the need for handouts isn't going away.
The BBC's Michelle Fleury reporting on a different side of life from what they like to call the economic or the business capital of the world, New York. Don't forget the latest business news, always available for you on our website, bbcworldservice.com/business.
The BBC World Service in the United States is distributed by Public Radio International. Distribution is made possible in part by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. More information online at gatesfoundation.org, and by individual donors to PRI, whose contributions help bring innovation and diversity to public radio programming.
WILL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois.
WILL programming is made possible by Columbia Street Roastery, offering over 30 varieties and blends of whole bean or ground coffee at 24 East Columbia in Champaign. Coffee, tea, and chai are available from their retail store, in local restaurants, and through Columbia Street Roastery's coffee service. More information is available at 352-9713.
BBC.
BBC.
You're with the BBC. Coming up on Outlook, after the latest BBC News, a special programme about a year in the life of one farming family in the American state of Massachusetts. Chip and Sherry Hagar farm about 700 acres and keep over 100 cows. But when the milk price tumbles, they face real challenges to make ends meet. Their story's on Outlook with me, Matthew Bannister, after the news.
BBC News with Victoria Meakin. A new free trade area, the world's largest in terms of population, is coming into effect in East Asia. It'll consist of China and six Southeast Asian countries. The aim is to accelerate inter-regional trade and reduce Asia's reliance on developed economies who've been weakened by the global downturn. The US Central Intelligence Agency has suffered its biggest loss in more than 25 years with the death of eight Americans in a suicide bombing at a base in Afghanistan on Wednesday night. The Taliban said the bomber was one of their number who was working as an Afghan army officer and bypassed security at the base. A gunman has shot and killed five people in Espoo in Finland before apparently committing suicide. Four of the victims died when the man opened fire in a crowded shopping mall. Police later discovered the fifth body, believed to be the gunman's former partner, in a flat nearby. The gunman's body was then found in another flat. The founder and chairperson of the non-profit organisation BRAC, Fazle Hassan Abed, is to be knighted by Queen Elizabeth for his fight against poverty in Bangladesh and other countries in Asia and Africa. Mr. Abed is the first Bangladeshi to be honoured with a knighthood. The United Nations is temporarily withdrawing some of its international staff from Pakistan for security reasons. Only non-essential staff are being moved out, and the UN said aid operations for refugees or people displaced by fighting wouldn't be affected. A painting by the Impressionist Degas has been stolen from a gallery in France. The painting, called The Chorus, with an estimated value of $45 million, disappeared from an exhibition in Marseille. Police say there was no sign of a break-in at the gallery. Finally, the golfer Tiger Woods has lost another major sponsor following the revelations about his marital infidelities. The American telecoms company AT&T has joined the consultancy firm Accenture in ending its sponsorship deal with Woods. BBC News.
Hello and welcome to Outlook from the BBC World Service. I'm Matthew Bannister. Today, a special programme focusing on farming in the USA. Not so long ago, most people in the US were farmers, but now only about 1 in 100 works the land. And yet, farmers and ranchers are as important as ever. They're the stewards of almost half the land in North America. And most of the country's agriculture is still run by families. Earlier this year, we followed one of them in our series Five Farms in collaboration with Public Radio International. The Hager family own a 700-acre dairy farm in Massachusetts. Chip and Sherry Hager run the farm, along with their daughter Kim and son-in-law Aaron and another son, Todd. Both Kim and Aaron are college graduates with degrees in agriculture. John Bewin of the Centre for Documentary Studies at Duke University followed the family through the different farming cycles of the year.
Snow is melting off the farmhouse in hefty clumps. It's a pretty scene, but the Hagers don't have time to stand around admiring it. As dairy farmers, they work 14-hour days year-round. In February and March, they add another crop to their workload, maple sap.
I'm Chip Hager. If the fog was a little bit higher, you could see off to the north here, the top of the ridge right there is Vermont. as the crow flies, it's only about 2 miles to Vermont. We own 750 acres. About 650 of it are up here in the hills. And the hills are quite steep, most all with a little stream in the valleys between. Just below the fog over there, you can see snow through the trees. That's one of our sugar bushes that we tap. Where our maple trees grow, we refer to that chunk of land as our sugar bush.
I'm Todd Hager. I'm Chip and Sherry Hager's son. I'm the youngest son out of four of us. I've got a wife, three little girls, and a great job. We call it Billy Goat Country. Pretty much a vertical hill. It's all covered with ice. Very windy because it's very exposed. So it's a lot of fun. These are the spigots. They're little round plastic pieces, about a quarter of an inch in diameter. Drill a hole in the tree and just simply pound it in. It's got to be hundreds of miles of tubing out here. It looks like a spider web almost. Various colored lines running here, there, and everywhere. And the lines are all neon green and neon blue, so they're very easy to see. And it carries it all back down through a series of vacuum boosters and other main lines to the tanks, which we pump out and bring to the sugar house. I'm getting the sap piping, the tubing, ready to go for the repairs. Unfortunately, this year we've had an abnormally amount of coyote destruction. Just for fun, as far as we can tell, it's just something to chew on. And so just about every single line from tree to tree has got a spot where it's got a hole chewed in it. And at 10 cents a foot, stuff is not cheap to replace. And we go through quite a few rolls of it. The whole system up here is all run off of vacuum. And so if there's one small little pinhole leak, it lets the air in and completely defeats the whole purpose of having the vacuum. The pipe is very rigid, so it can be quite a pain to get over the fittings. It's really a meticulous and painstaking process to go through it all, but it has to be done.
Well, maple sugar, and I think, is one of the riskiest and out-of-control crops that's farmed. It's completely, entirely dependent upon the temperature of the day. Just a couple of degrees, a breeze, the sun or no sun, that can make a difference of whether you get a harvest that particular day. This building, just like a lot of the other buildings on the farm, this is a sugar house. It's been built piece by piece over the generations. The back part over there was the original sugar house here, probably the 1800s at some point. Today's March 20th. This is the fifth day we've boiled this year. They're right after. All right. Sherry and I tend to most of it. Then Kim helps out what she can out here in between tending the cows.
I would say sugaring is the busiest time for the length of it because it goes on for about a month. And, you know, the cows don't stop, so we need to keep everything going. Was just shaking the fire. We put wood in it, and then 5 minutes later we shake it, and then 5 minutes later we put more wood in it, and just keep doing that.
Many people think that syrup has to be scorched to taste like maple syrup. Well, it doesn't. If it's scorched, it tastes burnt. It's just, it needs to be cooked for a certain length of time in order to make the maple flavor that we know as maple flavor. Quality seems to be real good. The flow has been pretty good. The forecast for the weather for the next couple of weeks looks real good. So about 40 degrees during the day and sunny, and down to about 20 or the high teens at night and clear. So it should get a good freeze and a good thaw every day. That's what we need. looking like it could be a good year. I'll tell you after the season's over whether it was a good year.
Well, Todd Hager finished off what turned out to be a successful maple sugaring season at the end of March. You're listening to Outlook on the BBC World Service, following the farming year of the Hager family from Massachusetts. By late spring, Todd and his father Chip are getting ready to plant the corn that will help to feed the family's herd of 110 dairy cows. While Todd works, his mother Sherry sometimes looks after his children, her grandchildren, in the main farmhouse.
Julia is in first grade now, and Riley will start preschool next year. Yeah.
Oh. You hit me.
Oh, we can't have any hitting. Julia?
What?
Did you hit your sister?
I said, please stop it.
Did you hit your sister, though?
She wrecked this.
Yeah, but we don't hit. What do we do when we're having a problem? How do we solve it?
Sorry.
Do we use our words?
Words.
Yes, words are better. You know, there's something about farming that people, I don't think that people see, but we can farm and be a family. I mean, where can you experience something like that? Certainly not in the business world, in the workforce. I can be here and I can make lunch for the help and I can work on the books, but I can still enjoy my children's children. And it's just awesome. It doesn't get any better.
I'm Todd. It is May 19th, I believe. It's unusually cold for May 19th. Very windy, and it's just not a fun day to be outside. This is one of our two biggest fields. It's a beautiful field. It's all river bottom land right next to the historic covered bridge. And we're trying like hell to get the field harrowed so we can get the corn planted as soon as possible. My job today is just to follow around with the wheel harrows and try and till in all the manure that they spread onto the field before the nitrogen evaporates. Unfortunately, this field was washed out a couple of years ago in a flood, so the soil is full of river rock, and every once in a while you catch one as quite a few of the discs are already broken off, but one of the ones I caught just cracked the disc and bent it around so it was getting caught and wasn't spinning. So I'm just trying to beat it back into shape with a rock.
Growing up on the farm is probably where I learned most of what I know, which I'm still learning every day working with my father and my sister and everybody else. But it just gives you a great respect for the land and for where we live. It took me quite a long time to realize that it was more than just being a stupid farmer or a dumb farmer. And I always had respect for my father and how hardworking he was. That was never in question. But I always felt like I wanted to be something more, something better. You go to school after getting up and milking cows in the morning, and it's inevitable that you're still going to smell like a cow. I got picked on quite a bit, and mainly starting out, I was a lot smaller than a lot of the other kids and a little bit more insecure. When I got bigger, they stayed smaller, and I made them stop picking on me, which is, again, not the right way to do things, but it's how I dealt with it. I actually left the house at 18, but I kind of signed off of the farm a while before that, probably about 15 or 16. I stopped working at the farm. I took a part-time job at a fast food restaurant. I tried out a whole bunch of different careers. I've been a carpenter, I've been a mechanic. I'm a licensed vehicle inspector for the state of Massachusetts. Tried a number of different things, and it always came back to wanting something in a job that I could find right here. I wanted to be able to work with my hands, and the best part of working on a farm is at the end of the day, you can sit back and say, I did that, or I planted that, or and looking at the animals and seeing how healthy they are. You fed them, you cleaned them, you took care of them. Kim was actually in college when I left the farm. She went straight out of high school into college to be a farmer. I don't know, she's always seen something more in it than I did. I don't know if it, she had more self-confidence than I did, or she saw what I just recently saw at a lot younger age.
This is our first calf out of the sire Jambalaya. About an hour and a half old. We are taking her out of the calving pen and putting her in her own hutch so the mama can go eat and I can feed her.
They usually weigh around 95 to 100 pounds, so we generally don't try to carry them too far.
My name is Aaron Stevens. I am the son-in-law to the owner. Married Kim about January 12th.
We got a little cart here that we put the calves in. They don't generally walk where you want them to walk. Calves don't herd, so you can't push them in one direction or push them in the other. So we got this little cart that we throw them in, and they get to ride to their new little home.
The best part of working on a farm is at the end of the day, you can sit back and say, I did that, or I planted that, or then looking at the animals and seeing how healthy they are. You fed them, you cleaned them, you took care of them. It's just a lot of pride to be had being a farmer that I didn't see for a long time.
In the summer and the autumn, the Hagers harvest hay and corn to feed their cows. In the late winter, they tap maple sap and boil it down to syrup. But the most important harvest on the Hager farm happens twice a day, 365 days a year, the milking of the family's 110 dairy cows. Most dairy farms rely on a natural cycle that hasn't changed over time. The Hagers have pasture lands where for much of the year their cows eat the grass. In the winter, the Hagers supplement that diet with hay and corn silage grown on their own and neighbours' lands. Their decision to add fertiliser to their fields means that they can't label their milk organic. But this leads to an ongoing debate in the Hager household, as Chip told John Bewin of the Documentary Studies Department at Duke University.
Well, organic is fine. I have nothing against organic. It's a whole different style than what I use. I feel we're great stewards of the land, and what we contribute far outweighs any detriment we do by our practices of farming.
On the July day Chip made that comment, he was planning to cut some hay from a neighbor's field. It's a common arrangement. The farmer maintains another landowner's acreage in return for the right to cut hay from it. But Chip wasn't happy with the crop he was about to harvest.
The people that own it want to keep it organic, so we're limited on how we can care for it, as far as commercial fertilizer and so forth. As a result, the nutrition of the field is not optimum for a large yield, and the grass that's growing there is not a prime feed grass. That particular field is fairly far away. If we were to haul manure there, that's an hour's round trip with a truck, and diesel fuel is running in the neighborhood of $5 a gallon. So to put the money into the fuel and the effort is really not viable, dollars and cents-wise.
The Hagers do not inject their cows with growth hormone. That's a red flag for many consumers, dairy companies, and restaurants. But they do use antibiotics to treat infected cows, another practice that's banned for organic producers. Chip and Sherry Hager's oldest daughter, Kim, and her husband, Aaron, milk the family's dairy herd each morning.
I'm down in the milking parlor pit, getting some towels ready to wipe the cows before they get the milking machines put on them.
We start milking in the morning around 4. It usually takes us a couple hours. Currently, we're milking about 111. We're pretty small compared to some, but about medium size around here.
In the morning, we get out here. It's still dark out, and we're in here just, Aaron and I, just milking away. We don't generally talk that much. We just kind of do our thing.
There's 14 cows on a side. We have a swing 14, which is what our parlor is called, which means we have 14 milkers. We milk one side, and then they swing over, and we milk the other 14 cows. It takes about 15 minutes or so aside. When they come in, we'll force strip the teats. We put our fingers on the top of the teat and we work it down. It's pretty much what they did when they were milking by hand, only we just take a couple of squirts just to stimulate the cow. And then after that, we put a sanitizing solution on, which kills all the bacteria on the outside of the teat. That way the milkers, when they go on, everything is clean.
These two cows right here have been treated with... These red bands on their legs signify that they've been treated with antibiotics because they have mastitis problems. So they have to be milked into the pail.
This is Chip. People talk about wanting to go back to the old ways so things are more sustainable, but the older farms, a lot of them just plain were not sustainable. Not in the definition of sustainable we think about. I mean, they were very polluting. They were, they went as far until the soil was run out or until something brought them to an end, and they just ended. And we have to try to make sure we don't get ourselves headed in that direction.
Well, I mean, in order to do a good job, you have to know the science behind it. Otherwise, you just bang your head against the wall wondering why you have problems. And you can treat problems or you can find out why there are problems and handle it beforehand. Like, we do a lot of vaccinations to combat problems before they happen. And you can spend a lot of time treating cows for mastitis, which is udder infections. Or you can spend more time keeping them clean and vaccinating for certain types of bacteria that flourish in the environment. It's a win-win situation when you can stay ahead of the problems.
We have to live by pollution rules and regulations. We have to live by food and feed quality regulations. You know, where we can plant, you know, we have to be careful about erosion, and we can't be spreading fertilizer or whatever that's going to run off, even spreading manure, which is organic, that's going to run off into the water. Everything we do, every direction we head, we have to look at sustainability, whether it is environmental sustainability, monetary sustainability, our own well-being sustainability. We, you know, you have to keep that in mind all the time.
Even though the mastitis treatments have what they call withdrawal time labels on the back, we always sample the milk just to be sure there's no antibiotics in it. So this is what's called a Delvo test kit. And you put a sample of milk in these little vials and incubate it. Farmers don't want antibiotic milk.
As the autumn turns to winter, milk prices plummet and the financial picture turns bleak on the Hager farm. Even in the best of times, the Hagers make just a few pennies profit from a gallon of milk, and now that the price has fallen, they've been losing money with each milking, as Chip explains.
The bottom's dropped out of the milk market, and we're still having to feed that was very expensive to put up last summer because the price of fuel was high and fertilizer was high, and that all carries right through, so we're making a cheap product with expensive materials. So it's a major crash.
On average, in Massachusetts, as in a lot of places, we're looking at $21, $22 a hundredweight cost of production. And when the actual price goes down lower than that, of course, you know, we eat ourselves from within. It's chew up your equity, chew up your savings.
In December, we were getting an $18 milk price. Next month, it's going to be $11.
Chip's 30-year-old daughter, Kim Stevens, does the bookkeeping for the farm.
We saw our income from the milk check drop well over $10,000 in a month. That's a big amount of money to make up. Luckily, we have First Pioneer Farm Credit, which is our primary lender, who is very cooperative, understands dairy business very well, and are willing to help a lot of the farms in the area cash flow themselves until the price goes back up.
And you can only do that for so long, and I really question this time around how many guys are going to stick with it. I mean, everybody that's still making milk in Massachusetts is pretty dedicated and been at it a long time and willing to ride out the storm, but on the other hand, with the whole economy looking poor. I don't know if that's going to leave it so people will stick with it longer because they know there's nothing else they can do, or whether they're just going to say, hey, things are really looking bad and bail.
One thing that will help the family stay on the land is outside employment. Most farm families supplement their incomes with jobs off the farm. At age 52, Sherry Hager is a student at Greenfield Community College, working toward a nursing degree.
You see, now my Spanish 101 teacher said that the only time you roll the R's is when it's a double R, like payro means butt, but payro means dog.
Perro and perro.
Right.
Payro and
not it's pay, it's
perro.
So I'm taking anatomy and physiology too, and Spanish for nursing. I just went back to school, but there's no way that I'm going to be able to let go of the farm. I mean, I already have it in my head that, you know, I'm going to work my 12-hour shifts 3 days a week, and I'm going to farm 4 days a week.
You know, there's most any job that is out there is more financially beneficial than working here on the farm, and definitely fewer hours. Our oldest son was here, left. It was a dollars and cents issue.
My older brother used to work here and decided it wasn't really for him. He's a security guard at a nuclear plant.
So he's compensated well, and his hours are not the greatest, but better than firemen. And our youngest daughter...
My younger sister... really, has never been into the cows, only when I dragged her.
So she's an RN, works in the intensive care unit of local hospital.
I'm really the only one that, from the get-go, went to college for ag and decided that's what I wanted to do.
Kim is our oldest daughter, and Todd is the youngest son. Both of them are interested. And of course, Kim's husband is here. Todd's wife is a registered nurse, works in a nursing home.
Last I checked, my wife's still okay with me being here, so. Every day I get to work next to my father. I mean, you can't beat that. My sister, my brother-in-law. No, yeah, my mother's lunch. You can't beat that either. Can't get that in a restaurant. Everybody gets along. And we're family. We don't always get along. But 99% of the time, we're friends, not just family, so. I'm not going anywhere, as long as I can do it.
I still got my head stuck in the sand. You know, because we're diversified, it gives us the ability to stick with it a little bit easier. The young folks are really dedicated to follow through. And, oh, we're here for the long haul.
No, I don't think so. Anything that's been mowed this year, mow.
Okay.
When you're coming down alongside the road, that's just below the telephone pole there, that's partway up in the field,
mm-hmm.
There's a dip down.
The information that's in that man's head, the farm would not function if he just left tomorrow. I don't care what anybody says, and that's nothing against Kim and Aaron or anybody else here, but, I mean, he's a walking owner's manual and reference to every single thing that's here, everything that goes on, from the business end to the animals to the machinery.
There's a rock right on the hump as it pitches over there that sticks up. You gotta lift more up like the first, second time around.
Okay.
When it heads down over, it'll hit that and bust your knives every time.
Okay. And so hopefully, before he decides to retire and move to Florida or something, I work with him enough so that I've got at least a portion of it in my head. I mean, it not only does he have his knowledge, but he's got all the knowledge that his father gave to him, and so it's a scary thought of trying to run the farm without him being here.
No, I've just decided I'm just going to live forever.
That's good with me.
Chip and Todd Hager on their farm in Massachusetts. Well, that's all from Outlook for today. I'm Matthew Bannister. If you'd like to hear from some other families that John Bewin had been following, you can visit our website at bbcworldservice.com/outlook and just click on the heading Five Farms.
Today's programs are made possible by 10,000 Villages in downtown Champaign, offering fairly traded holiday gift items for both family and friends, from coffee and teas to a collection of soaps, paperweights, and stationery. 10,000 Villages features games, toys, musical instruments, and more.
Our forecast is for mostly cloudy skies today, and the temperature falling to around 26 by this evening. Wind from the west at 6 to 13. Tonight, partly cloudy, low around 9, wind chills below zero. We'll start the new year tomorrow, partly sunny, with a high near 15, wind chills still below zero. Saturday and Sunday, mostly sunny, highs in the mid-teens. This is the Illinois Public Media, WILL, AM 580 and FM 90.9, HD2 and HD3 Urbana.